This podcast of Snap Judgment is supported by MailChimp. More than 3 million people and businesses use MailChimp to design and send email newsletters. MailChimp also distributes hats for cats and small dogs. More at MailChimp.com. So, in university, I had to go to summer school, right? To catch up on some credits. So, I signed up for this psychology class. And on the first day, we're all sitting there waiting. And finally, the professor comes in. Big, jolly dude, shock black hair. He tells us, "Please, look into the back of the room." We do, and there's a table with a sheet over it. He runs to the back, snatches the sheet off like a magician. And there are various bottles of wine, sliced cheese, smoked salmon. "Who amongst you enjoys wine?" What is this, a trick question? We're students. We like everything. "Come. Come and imbibe in my tasting." All of a sudden, it's a party. We're drinking some of everything, whatever's closer. "Don't mind if I do. Yeah, I want some more of that." And in short order, we demolished the table. Class dismissed. Best lecture ever. The next day we come in, and this time, it's a little different. The professor starts in on actual psychology. He tells us that it doesn't matter what you see or hear or feel. What matters is how you interpret the information. He reaches down, comes up with two bottles. "This wine hails from the coastal Bordeaux region. This other comes from Burgundy, a much cooler clime that, in my humble opinion, produces a superior product." He pours us small glasses. "Taste for soil, taste for wind, for salt. This is the inferior. This is the superior. Do you taste it?" We taste. Class dismissed. Every day, first from psychology. "Your world, it is not out there. Your world lives inside you. You construct, you build every minute of every hour." And now, for some wine. And he would pour and teach. "Can you taste how they tease the minerals from clay soil? This came not from a field fit for corn or for beans, no. This came from a barren vineyard whose grapes had to be sucked and coaxed and teased from the land. This is how you make the best. See, smell, hear, touch with your tongue. Not your finger, Mr. Washington. Stimulate all the senses first. Now, taste. Which is the quality? Which is the swill? Tell me." And finally, the last day of class, professor runs his giant frame to the back again, goes to the same table, and tears off the sheet. "Drink. Every wine is exactly as it was before. Party time." We run back and start pouring wine. Cheers! We look, we smell, we touch, we drink. We spit almost simultaneously. Pure nastiness. We open another bottle and another. Each is unfit for cleaning restrooms. Why? Whatever is the problem? Everyone is exactly the same as before. What? Perhaps. Perhaps it is you who are now different. There's a pause, and we got it. It didn't matter what we saw, what we smelled, what we touched. What mattered was how we put it all together. He had changed how we put it together. That was perception. How we labeled these sensations in our mind became how we created our own universe. The class actually clapped. The professor took a bow, then he pointed to a different table. Now, it is time we enjoy some real wine. Today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present Senseless. Amazing stories from people struggling to construct their own world. My name is Glenn Washington. Send everyone out on a 10-mile run because you're busy listening to Snap Judgment. Now, what do you value most? Think about it, because we're going to kick off the Snap Judgment Senseless episode with a story from Mike May. And let's see if he changes your mind about what is important.
That was just such a weird thing to do. Actually, climb out of an airplane and stand on the wheel struts and hold on under the wing. And you would think you'd just get blown off, but now you're 3,000-4,000 feet above the ground and just standing there.
This is Mike May's first time skydiving. He loves these kinds of stunts, and it's a real stunt because Mike is blind.
So when I arched back and I dropped off, people have described to me what it looks like flying over things, and I just pictured it was like that in my mind's eye. The point where I heard the vehicles, and then they got louder as I got closer down, that was my equivalent probably of a sighted person seeing the ground get closer. I felt the whoosh and the tug and the chute open. And here your feet are loose, you know, they're just hanging in the air from this harness, floating down. It was such a crazy experience.
Mike has been blind since he was 3 years old. One day, he was making a mud pie in his backyard. He needed something to scoop water with, so he grabbed a jar that he didn't know had a chemical called calcium carbide in it.
And I took it over and put it in a trough of water, like a little tub.
The problem was that when calcium carbide, the chemical in the jar, touches water, it turns into a flammable gas. So when Mike dipped the jar, the gas was created.
And next to that tub happened to be a pile of burning garbage.
The gas was ignited.
And I'm blown sky high.
When he woke up, he had 300 stitches and he was blind. But his mom made a point of not treating it like a tragedy. So he grew up never letting his blindness stop him from doing anything.
I don't ever remember thinking, self-pity, I'm blind. I would think about frustrating aspects of being blind that I didn't like. My friends are going up skiing and there's not enough drivers. If I could drive, I would be going. That really was annoying and frustrating. But I didn't think, oh shoot, if I wasn't blind, this wouldn't be a problem.
It's funny that you say all my friends are going skiing and I can't go because there's not enough drivers.
Yeah.
I was thinking you were going to say I can't go because I can't ski. I can't.
No, that never occurred to me.
Mike is an adrenaline junkie, so doing whatever he wants to do, that can mean some pretty extreme things. Like, he didn't just learn how to downhill ski, he won a gold medal for downhill ski racing. Then he went after the downhill speed skiing record.
40 miles an hour, 50 miles an hour, 60, 65. At 65, you're moving pretty good. So when we finished that day, we did 65. For me, it was a big disappointment. For the rest of the world, they say 65 miles an hour, totally blind. Yeah, it's amazing.
By the time he was 46, he had a wife and kids, a successful tech startup. He was a ski racer and a skydiver. Basically, he'd had a more exciting life than most sighted people. He became kind of a poster boy for what blind people can do. Until one day at the doctor's office, his doctor, Dr. Goodman, offered him a chance to do the one thing he thought he never would be able to do.
He sits me in the chair, he takes a look at my eye, and he first introduces this idea. You know, if the surface of your eye is the only thing that's damaged, there might be a possibility you could have some sort of repair. Then you might be able to see.
The doctor was offering him a shot at seeing, but he didn't jump at the chance.
I made my list of the pros and the cons, and the list of cons was pretty long.
And really?
Here I'd spent my life cultivating the philosophy that I could do anything, almost, anytime, anywhere, as a blind person. And now all of a sudden I decide I'm going to have vision. I'm undercutting this lifelong philosophy. It just didn't line up.
Mike had spent his life doing things like ski racing and skydiving to show himself in the world that blind people could do almost anything sighted people could do. So he worried that getting the surgery would imply that there is something wrong with being blind.
There might be some pushback from the larger blindness community because people would either be jealous or they'd think that I was not supporting the fact that blind people can do cool things and do things well. There was all these concerns around how this would play out.
For those blind people that had opted for the surgery, it hadn't exactly been a miracle.
Everybody who's had restoration of sight has had some really bad ramification, even to the point of committing suicide.
Well, why?
Because when you get the vision, it's a lot of work. It's overwhelming. It's mentally taxing.
Most people didn't get all their sight back, and what they could see, they had a hard time understanding. Their eyes might work, but their brain was out of practice. They couldn't tell the difference between a pile of dirt in front of them and a mountain in the distance. One guy almost fell out of a window trying to reach out and grab the cars in the street below him. But there's one particularly compelling reason on his short list of pros.
Curiosity. Everybody teased about things, you know, going to topless beaches and strip clubs and things like that. Okay, well, you know, that's real deep. But it really evolved into something much bigger as I thought about it. How much of our world is based in visual perception, not just the actual vision, but if you think about a book, people are creating imagery based on what people see.
Most of all, Mike wondered what it would be like to be able to see faces. Know what a knowing smile looked like. Know what his wife looked like when she was sad.
To me, that would be the most interesting thing about being able to recognize a face, to recognize expressions.
In the end, the decision came down to one thing. Obviously, Mike's kind of an extreme guy, and trying out sight would be a kind of ultimate challenge.
If I don't do it, then I'm not being Mike May. If I'm a pioneer, then this is something I have to do whether I want to or not.
So Mike went in for the surgery.
He said, if there's any vision to be gained, we figure it's going to take a couple weeks.
They bandaged up his eyes, and he went back into the doctor's office the next day to check on the wounds.
So I go in, sit down in the chair, and we chit-chat and pull the bandages off. And all of a sudden, there's this whoosh of light. Visual stuff starts flooding in. This tsunami of visual stuff that was just switched on like a faucet. So I'm looking at the doctor's face, pink blob. I'm looking at the machine, black stuff. This 10 seconds felt more like a minute because the world is coming to me in, you know, normal video is something like 32 frames a second. And I'm in a situation where I can, if I'm lucky, I can process one frame every 10 seconds. And then there was a mirror there, and Dr. Goodman says, well, can you see yourself? And that was a weird thing, to lean into the mirror and see my face and to move back and forth a little bit and see that the thing in the mirror was moving according as to how I was moving. And then I had this feeling of invading a person's space. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, that's my space. But I still had that feeling that I was too close. But at this point, I said something inane like, holy smokes. Who says holy smokes when they can see for the first time after 43 years? What a dumb thing to say. Then the world started unrolling one image at a time. We get up and leave the doctor's office. I mean, I was going about half a mile an hour because everything was interesting. I'm looking at the carpet going, wow, this carpet is fascinating. And Jennifer says, what do you mean it's fascinating? I said, well, there's all these colors. I mean, why aren't people more excited about carpet? And then I get in a car, and now we're moving at even higher speeds, and I'm seeing cars whizzing next to us and thinking, oh my gosh, how does the world go along calmly with these other 3,000-pound obstacles, projectiles right next to you? She wasn't even fazed. She's just driving along the freeway, no big deal. I went to my first baseball game, and I remember I talked the ticket taker into getting me seats right behind home plate so I could actually see the batter. And I saw the guy's foot going up and down as he's getting ready to hit the ball. And I thought, I've listened to baseball since I was 7 years old. Nobody's ever said anything about the fact that the guy's foot is going up and down, almost tapping. And I found that fascinating, that something could go on in the world for so many years. Everybody sees it. Nobody says anything about it.
Mike figured he would continue to get better and better at seeing. But over the next couple of years, he slowly found out that the world never would come fully into focus.
Completely incompetent at face recognition. It didn't work at all, not with my kids or my wife or anybody familiar. It's just not going to happen. Your brain is not going, it's too set in its ways, if you will, and so you're not going to be able to evolve to that point.
Mike also found that not only could he not see some things a fully sighted person could see, but that things that used to be easy were actually a lot harder with sight. It was easy not to be afraid of what he couldn't see.
And primarily this had to do with skiing, where the vision was an impediment. It wasn't a benefit. Because obstacles would be visually apparent to me, whereas when I was blind, I was just focusing on the sound of the guide, and all of a sudden now I'm seeing things and I wouldn't know the difference between a hole in the ground, a shadow, a tree. They all look the same. And in some of those cases, it's a bad thing. The shadow is okay, but if it's a hole or a tree or a person, that's bad. And those were all very distracting. One time I was in a store and reached out to feel what I thought was some clothing on a rack, and in fact it was a person. But it was just embarrassing to all of a sudden have a live person under my hand rather than, oh my gosh. In the beginning, I was thinking about, I have this visual tool and I have my auditory and sensory tools, tactile and so forth. But this vision one is really pretty poor. I mean, I'm 20 over 1,000 technically on the eye chart, which is pretty bad. I can't read print. I can't recognize faces. This seems like it wasn't really worth all that much to get some bright colors and so forth.
But then Mike realized something. He could just think of his sight differently, as a kind of new disability that he needed to find a new set of workarounds for, just like he did when he was blind.
Once I started integrating the vision with my blindness and figuring out, okay, let's use all the tools together, then it started to be much more powerful. For example, when I'm walking through an airport and I'm wondering, well, where's the restroom? Well, there's a placard right at about usually a 4 or 5 foot level next to the door It's dark in color, maybe blue, that has the men or women sign on it. And I look for a doorway that has that next to it. So I walk along visually scanning for that. I see a doorway. Does it have a placard next to it? Yep. Now I go over to it. I can reach up and read Braille. Boom.
Now that Mike has figured out how to use what sight he has to his advantage, he has a message for other blind people. This sight you wish you had? It's overrated.
People who say, you're crazy, this icing on the cake thing or this fact that it's not that big a deal, I don't believe it. I don't buy it. You know, that's just rhetoric.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, that's the thing I'm having a little bit of trouble with.
Oh, yeah. It's more sighted people that don't believe me than blind.
Oh, that's interesting. Why do you think that is? Because we're awesome?
You think you're awesome, you got this sight, and you can't believe that you could do without it. I mean, it's inconceivable. A blind person can at least conceive of, hey, life is good. I mean, vision would be fun, but it wouldn't be that big a deal. It is, because when you haven't been blind, there's this perception that it's such a scary world, and it can be scary and frustrating. There's no doubt about it. It doesn't have to be the dark world that it's perceived to be. If you put a blindfold on for a couple of hours, or you go to one of these dining in the dark restaurants, that's not the way it's going to be for your life. That's just how it is for that night.
I've done everything I can to teach other blind people that, hey, guess what? You may think on the other side of the fence is this great sighted world, but from what I can see, it's cool, but it's not that big a deal. So just get on with being blind, get on with developing the tools. That's really where you should be focusing your energy. And this other stuff is just for fun.
Big thanks to Mike May for sharing his world with Snap. That piece was produced by Julia DeWitt. Okay, so recently, Snap producers Pat Mesiti-Miller and Nick Vanderkolk were moping around the office because their lady friends were out of town. Nick got a bright idea to ask Pat out on a special man date. But he didn't tell him where he was taking him.
I don't know if I'm nervous, but I'm excited. I'm a little nervous. I've definitely ran through my mind what he possibly could be. The nice attire, you told me to dress up nice. So that's kind of weird. I've never been to a place that's nice, that's like weird. But I have a feeling it's gonna make me uncomfortable. So that's kind of what I'm looking forward to. I was kind of hoping that it would be like a place with strippers and beef stroganoff. That would have been pretty cool.
Oh, let's do that.
So maybe afterwards, if it's not that, we can go do that. I'm hoping it's not like a Renaissance themed thing. Yeah. I can't do the Renaissance thing. Hi, how's it going?
So welcome to Opaque. Tonight you get to pick an appetizer, an entree, and a dessert from our listings on these menus here. But we're also offering mystery options tonight for all those categories as well. And the mystery options are nowhere on the menu, so it's just a whole other thing we offer for the whole sensory experience of dining in the dark. All of the servers in the restaurant are blind or visually impaired, so they will be your guide for the remainder of dinner. So do ask when you enter Opaque, you turn off your cell phones or tuck away anything that makes any kind of light for the remainder of the evening.
Great.
Cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, this is going to be awesome. Yeah, man. In the dark?
Uh-huh. Okay, who's waiting for George?
That would be us.
Wander on you.
We're going to make one right turn and then you should be fine, okay?
All right.
There's going to be a little bit of a tent pole. You okay, Pat?
Yeah, I'm getting there.
All right. It'll be fine.
This is really dark.
Nick,
I'm going to put your hand on the table.
And now, Pat.
Yes, sir.
Reach out for me because I don't want to poke you.
Is that you?
Face, sir. Yep.
Gotcha.
Okay, and now,
here's the corner.
Okay.
Put your hand on the bench.
Wonderful.
And you're going to scoot in.
And I'm going to scoot in.
Mm-hmm. So,
I'm going to go in the back, get you some bread, some water, a little hors d'oeuvre. It's a sliced cucumber with smoked salmon and wasabi aioli. How's that?
George, that sounds fantastic.
Let each other know where everything is. Try not to do any abrupt motions. And if you need me, yell George, because you can tell waving will not work, okay?
Oh, man. This is really disorienting. Holy My eyes are so wide open right now, and I've got nothing going on.
Yeah.
Man, I'm not going to lie. My heart is kind of going, dude. I really want some light. All right, I gotta zen out. I'm not even kidding, dude. This is kind of intense. Uh-huh. Oh, my God.
My heart is beating, for sure. My sweaty palms, sweaty on my face. Forehead's sweaty.
Well, I'll be good. I'm calming down now. They got Luther playing in the background.
Never too much. Oh, yeah. Y'all got some Luther and everything. We'll be right back in just a moment to find out how Pat and Nick's meal is progressing. This is a Snap Judgment, the senseless episode. Stay tuned. Snap Judgment, the senseless episode. When last we left, our intrepid heroes, producer Nick Vanderkolk and Pat Mesiti Miller, were enjoying each other's company at the Opaque restaurant in San Francisco, where diners eat in pitch blackness. We're going to rejoin them while dinner is served.
So, Pat, I want to put you in charge of the bread basket since he's
playing
a trick with you.
You know me well. I love me some bread, so right, that's good.
So, thank you. I'll be back with the appetizer shortly, okay?
Appreciate you, man. Thank you much.
Thanks, George.
How you doing?
Much better. Oh, I just found the butter. Do you want some bread?
Yeah, sure. Let's
put your hand across the edge of the table.
Okay.
You want to try and meet halfway in the middle?
Yeah, sure. On your right
just
hand.
Just in
side.
The space, yeah. I'm going to put my right hand in the space. You go left hand and just slide it up. Hey, there's your...
Hey, what's up there, baby?
There you go. Just for you. Okay, I put the butter down somewhere. I don't remember where I put it. I'm not even kidding. I actually might have lost the butter. Oh, here it is.
Nick.
There's two different...
Mystery entrees. Mystery entrees?
Got that.
Oh, is that the beef?
No, there's no beef.
Oh. I thought it was beef because I really like beef, and I was hoping it was beef. It smells like a...
I gotta be honest.
Oh, man, this is delicious.
Yeah?
Dude, this is beef. You're trying to throw me off.
I've literally, the last five bites I've tried to take, I've put nothing to my mouth.
Well, now, we'll go over what's on your plates.
Okay. So, I'm thinking that I got couscous...
Polenta.
Oh, polenta. It was very delicious.
Polenta. Creamy Parmesan polenta.
Very delicious. Spinach?
Yes.
Nailed the spinach. I know me some spinach. And then you said it wasn't beef, but I really wanted to think that it was like a nice cut of beef. But the only thing I can think of is maybe lamb?
No.
Is it venison? Deer? Is it? It's not chicken.
I'm going to give you a hint. when the business that was trying to advertise it, they were advertising it as other white meat.
Oh, it's pork?
Mm-hmm.
That was pork.
It's a pork loin, yeah.
It's a pork loin. Oh, that's what it is, yeah.
I can't believe that didn't even come up as a possibility.
Is it pork?
Are you handing
pork's
me a plate?
Pork's a sleeper.
I'm just putting
everyone forgets about pork.
You know what? I really taste the pork. No. No, it's clear. Of course it's pork.
I have to admit that I've been helping to press whatever I'm eating into my fork before I eat it.
With your fingers?
Yeah.
You son of a...
Is that cheating?
Hell yeah, it's cheating. We can look on with the lights on, man, and everybody's around. You're just sitting there pressing food into your fork. Can't do that. I'm totally comfortable now. I'm totally down to hang out in the dark, man. We should do this more often.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh. All right, guys. Here is two mystery drinks. I just have to find the table. There we go.
Thanks, George. Meet me in the middle, man. That's cool. Cheers.
Cheers. Let's see
Salute.
If we can do this. Oh, yeah.
Nice. That was right on. That was perfect.
Thanks so much for taking us on your date, Pat and Sheedy Miller and Nick Vanderkolk. Special thanks as well to George and the Opaque in San Francisco. We'll have a link to their website on snapjudgment.org. Next up on Snap, we're going into the room where the senses get the most action. No, the kitchen. Molly Birnbaum tells us her story.
My love affair with food began when I was in college. So by the time I was ready to graduate, I knew without a doubt what I wanted, which was to be a chef. I spent a lot of time starting with herbs, like Syrian oregano and lemon thyme, and herbs that I had never really known to exist. So I began by smelling these herbs every single night as I plucked the leaves, because the chef that I was working for told me that the only way to become a chef was to know the ingredients. If he put a leaf of an herb on my tongue and I couldn't see it, I would know what it was immediately. So I was accepted into the Culinary Institute of America, which is one of the best culinary schools out there. A few months before I started at the Culinary Institute of America, it was August, an August morning. It was raining, and so I put the headphones of my iPod into my ears and went out on a run. And that's really the last thing I remember for a number of weeks. What happened, they would later tell me, is I was hit by a car. And when the car hit me, probably going around 40 miles an hour, I was pushed up onto the windshield. I broke the windshield with the back of my skull and then was flipped out onto the concrete to the side. I fractured my pelvis in two places. I fractured my skull and I tore the ligaments in my left knee pretty completely. The biggest thing was my head injury. I couldn't focus my eyes for weeks. I acted like I was drunk. I realized that something else was horribly wrong with me a few weeks after the accident. I was at my father's house, and my stepmother baked an apple crisp. And everyone in the room was oohing and aahing over the scent. But I inhaled and I exhaled and I couldn't smell anything. And I thought that maybe I was sitting in the wrong direction. But even when my stepmother Cindy brought the crisp out and held it under my nose, and, you know, I could feel the steam in my nostrils. I couldn't smell anything. And I knew then that I had lost my sense of smell. I realized immediately the implications of this were pretty huge, because smell is such an important part of flavor. Smell and taste together are what make up flavor in eating. Without a sense of smell, an apple crisp tastes like sugar. It tastes sweet, but the nuance of the appleness, like stewy fruit flavor, is not there. The cinnamon and the nutmeg and the butter flavor isn't there. I was missing all of the detail, all of the nuance, everything that makes food for me good. And I knew pretty immediately that I wouldn't be able to cook professionally, and I knew that I couldn't go to the Culinary Institute of America. Being in the kitchen was like being in this monotone hole that I didn't know how to deal with. One moment I remember a lot was I ate a lot of salsa, really spicy salsa, because I could feel it in my mouth. Like, I could feel the spiciness. It tingled. It was great because it was something. That was a smell that actually meant a lot to me, because when I was a little girl, my father and I would watch James Bond movies together on Sunday nights. We would eat chips and salsa as we watched, and the scent of salsa for so many years afterward would bring me back to those moments. And I really began to wonder, what else had I lost from my past? I missed those parts of myself that I knew were there, but just not as accessible or vibrant. And without a sense of smell, I wouldn't be able to make new memories like that, the ones that take you by surprise or a gut punch of emotion, the familiar but surprising scents. I began to get really curious about what was happening with the olfactory system in the human body, and I was really curious about who else had experienced this. Was I the only one, and was I the only one that cared so much? So I began reaching out to people, and one of my favorite ones was Ben of Ben & Jerry's, the ice cream company. He couldn't smell. He couldn't really smell since he was a kid. And the best part about this is that he told me that that's why Ben & Jerry's ice cream has so many chunks in it, because he's so attuned to texture. And this just made complete sense to me, because when you can't smell, what is really pleasurable is textural differences. And Ben & Jerry's ice cream was the best because it just has all this difference in there, all this textural perception. I began to write about my sense of smell and the science of smell and my experience cooking and eating with and without smell. And I really began to train myself to cook and to eat using my other senses, using sight, using sound even. I began to cook by listening a lot more. I mean, there are sounds in the kitchen that can tell you so much about what's happening in the pan, in the oven, and I just never thought about it before. It was a number of months after the accident. I was helping my mother to cook dinner. We were making lamb, and I was chopping the fresh herb rosemary, chopping, 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 and then all of a sudden, this scent just hit me out of the blue, and it was this huge scent. I had forgotten how powerful smell could be and that it could just totally take over my brain, and the smell was dark green and earthy and herby and reminded me of a moment from my childhood, the first time I rode a horse. There must have been rosemary plants out west. That first smell was glorious, and part of me thought, okay, this is it. Everything's coming back at once. But that wasn't the case. It took a long time for my sense of smell to come back. Over the course of years, I don't know, I think one way I've described it is walking outside at night in the pitch black, and then all of a sudden a street lamp comes on, and then as soon as you pass it, it turns off. When you're in the pitch black again. Some of the first scents were ones that meant the most to me emotionally, which I found really mysterious, but the scent of chocolate was one of the first ones to come back, and cucumbers. It's been 7 years since I was in the accident, and today I feel like I'm completely recovered. One thing that has changed most definitely is the attention that I pay. Losing my sense of smell made me incredibly mindful of all of my senses and my perception of flavor today. I think about it more. I concentrate on the tiny details of it more. And Paying attention has made almost everything taste better.
Molly Birnbaum now acts as an editor for America's Test Kitchen, where her job is to taste delicious things each and every day. Life is hard for Molly Birnbaum. She's got a book about her experience called Season to Taste. We'll have a link to it at snapjudgment.org. Today on Snap, it's a feast for your senses. The Snap Judgment Senseless episode continues in just a moment. Do stay tuned.
All men were created equal. MCs are uneven. Ask blind man Steven if he's even seen how the sunset looks. That's something you couldn't fail with a braille book. I'm here to smack your eardrum long. So come along, let's communicate with rhythm. Tell him to come along. You can smack.
Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the Senseless episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're exploring stories from real people who've lost track of their senses. And I don't know if you remember this, Snappers, but when we were all in elementary school, back in the days when schools were funded at least, they tested us to make sure that our senses, the ones we're talking about today, were functioning correctly. It's with one of these very tests that our next story starts.
One of the tests was a hearing test. They would file us all into the nurse's office and sit us down in front of this large box that had a bunch of knobs, and we'd put headphones on. The point was that the beep started out really quietly and would get louder. You had to raise your hand whenever you heard the beep. I could hear the beep, but I didn't raise my hand. I do sort of remember doing it gradually, but by like the fifth beep, I'd gotten really adventurous and waited so it was really super loud and obvious. Then I was like, I think that's it. I think I can hear it.
And Molly, do you remember why you did it?
I definitely knew that I wasn't popular. There were some like unbelievably, just even at that age, like strikingly beautiful girls. And everyone wanted to be their friend, and I was an overweight kid. I had a sense that I was unimportant, and so I would counteract that by making myself seem extremely important. Like, it would give people an awe that I was living this normal life and accomplishing these things that they were doing, but I was doing it with one ear. My only thing that I was thinking was, these kids are gonna think I'm awesome.
And did it work?
I did not get any of the attention I was hoping for. I don't think one person said, like, man, that's awesome. But I was like, you know, I was dug in and putting good money in after bad. I was like, I'm going to make this thing work. And I went home and I stole my dad's headphones. They were like the earbud kinds, which had just kind of come out as well. And I was like, this is exactly what a hearing aid would look like. So I just clipped it off the wire and stuck it in my ear. You know, it said like Sony on it. And went to school and like I probably put my hair back and sort of like turned into things. Oh wait, let me turn up my hearing aid because I can't hear you. That day, we were on the playground. This one kid, Ben, who I feel like was 11 feet tall. He had this huge scar on his chin. He was just this sort of scary, intimidating figure, and also was really popular. He sort of like sauntered up to me at the balance beams that we had on the playground. And he sort of looked in my ear and was like, what is that? You know, it's my hearing aid, Ben. And he was like, it's not a hearing aid. And there was like a couple other kids that started gathering around at this point. Ben sort of like reaches his hand out and palms it out of my ear. He was like, this isn't a hearing aid. It's a headphone. Guys, look, it's a headphone. Yeah. He threw it over the fence into like the woods behind the school. I was like, go get it. I was just sort of ostracized as being, you know, fat and a pathological liar. This totally backfired.
So how did you back it up? How did you get out of it?
It, you know, I think it got it out in me. I very strategically started getting a little bit better day after day.
And for a very long time, that was the end of it. It was a cute story about being a kid. Molly grew up to be a successful adult with lots of friends.
Well, you know, it's funny. I didn't think too much about it, but 25 years later, around 4 or 5 months ago, I woke up on a regular Saturday morning, and I could not hear out of my left ear. At all. So I went to the ear, nose, and throat doctor. The first thing they do is they give you a hearing test. She put headphones on, and I had to, instead of raising my hand, I just said yes when I heard the beep. And I broke down into tears in the booth before the hearing test even started.
You thought they were going to say you're going permanently deaf?
I was convinced that it was massive, permanent hearing loss. The doctor was just like, so you have conductive hearing loss in your left ear. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I can't believe that I put that out into the universe.
Did you think it was karma?
I'm not a cosmic retribution. I'm not one of that type of a person. But it's still, I still do think like, oh, I deserved it. I deserved it. You know, when you have two ears, it's like with sight, you have depth perception. And the minute you only have one ear collecting all of that information, everything sounds so much louder, like a roar. And the city becomes like this most really frightening place where sirens are just in your face and screaming babies are in your face. Everything is right there, even if they're actually a block away.
This isn't as funny as I thought it was going to be. It sounds scary.
It was really scary. I fell apart. I had to get put on anti-anxiety medication. Like, I was not in a good spot. It was the most dramatic, traumatic 2 months of my life.
Was it anything like you hoped it would be?
You know, probably. Yeah, I mean, no. It was partly what I hoped it would be. Just the other day, I got an email from a colleague that was like, how's your ear? Oh my God, we haven't checked in. And it was like, that was validation. And like, so she was thinking about me at that moment.
Wait, so even though it was kind of horrible and traumatic and awful, there was still some kind of, I don't want to say payoff, but like, there's still something in us as adults that's childlike in wanting attention. Is that right?
I'm horrified to talk about this, I'll be honest. The roots of why I had made it up in the first place was because I felt like it was something that was provocative that had happened to me. But now that it really happened, now when I go up to somebody and talk about my hearing loss, yes, it's not a lie, but it still gives me that same sense of being important that I was looking for 25 years ago.
Big thanks to Molly Sugarman for sharing that story of the Snap. The piece was produced by Anna Sussman. It's about that time. And I know what you're thinking. You're pondering, how do I get more Snap in my life? Well, it's a simple one-stop proposition. We call it snapjudgment.org. There, you can subscribe to the podcast, see Snap movies, pictures, stuff. Snapjudgment.org. And you might be thinking, Glenn, I'm allergic to websites. Well, not to fear, fellow traveler. iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, any service that sees this expensive, hard-to-produce content and hands it out for free, there you shall find the Snap. This program was produced by myself and the Snap Judgment, extra sensory, extra touchy-feely crew. Whose hand is that on my knee? It's the Uber producers, Mr. Mark Ristich. He walks these streets because he lives on beats. Pat Mastini Miller. No can do, Stephanie Fee. Anna, the orangutan whisperer, Sussman. Julia, the compass to wit. Lenzo Gorio plays darts blindfolded. Nick Vanderkolk can't taste rabbit. Will Urbina can taste rabbit. Now, did you ever have that neighbor knock on your bedroom door at 6 a.m. and ask to borrow some eggs and some toast and maybe some big cut bacon? Do you have any orange juice? Not to worry. That's just the Corporation for Public Broadcasting trying to start their day right. Give them a smile from us and get new locks. Much love to the CPB, PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, putting the public in public media and holding the public there until they say uncle. PRX.org. Now, you know this, but this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could get inside of one of those isolation and sensory deprivation chambers that the hippies use. Ah, sweet bliss. You could float there for your 15-minute session, only to discover they forgot about you and took off for the weekend. And after your screaming dies down and you finally decide to meditate the time away, you could emerge as a newborn saint 3 days later, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. This is